Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is hosted by the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton, and I will be serving as a moderator for the show. This show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, dial 347-994-1149. If you want to write that down, that is 347-994-1149. And after you dial that number, you can press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today, we're fortunate to have Linda Spears joining us. Linda has worked in frontline practice and at the senior management levels in child welfare services for nearly 30 years. She currently serves as the vice president of the Child Welfare League of America and heads the organization's work in policy and public affairs. Before joining CWLA, Linda served as director of field of support with the Massachusetts Department of Social Services. Linda is an enrolled member of the Narragansett Indian Tribe. She serves on the board of directors of the Family Violence Prevention Fund. She's also served as an advisor to the American Bar Association's Project for Judicial Excellence in Child Abuse and Neglect and to the Family Violence Department of the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, Lauren. How are you doing today?
Great. So turning to our subject, when we talk about children who are involved in the child dependency and delinquency systems, we refer to them as crossover youth. Mm-hmm. There is a documented relationship between childhood victimization and some form of delinquent behavior. Linda, when and why did this become a hot topic across the country?
Oh, gosh, I think it actually evolved over many, many years, probably a frustration and failure. I think, you know, going back to 25, 30 years ago when I was in the front lines and program management in the field, there was a lot of going back and forth even then between the child welfare system and the juvenile justice systems about whose responsibility were these kids, whose job was it, how do we solve it, what do we do? And I think there was many years where people were just frustrated. I think probably, you know, more than a decade ago, folks like Janet Wiig and Kathy Spatz-Whittem and others across the country began to look more in depth at this issue and really document the correlation between and the relationship between the kids and the juvenile justice system and the child welfare system, and really began to document the fact that kids were going from one system into another. And, you know, localized studies, particular individual studies in individual states and surveys, has continued to, over the years, reinforce those early findings about what was happening for kids. So I think that was part of it. I think as the population, the troublesomeness of kids, the challenges that kids face today, and the behavioral and emotional and system challenges and the kids face and the systems face in solving these problems that the children have, has made the issues even more to the forefront. So I think people got it, you know, and I think people came together because everyone was struggling with it. And I think some good creative ideas had started to come about how do we begin to understand what's happening here, understand why it's happening, and see some potential solutions. And I actually think the hope of solutions is why this has become something that people have really grappled with. And I think they don't any longer see it as just a reality of how both systems work and just a necessary evil. I think people believe that there are solutions to this problem.
And I'm sure our listeners really do want to hear what some of those solutions have been, what communities are trying. I'd like to step back and sort of talk about the research first, because I saw this statistic that being abused or neglected as a child increases the likelihood of arrest as a juvenile by 59%. So that, you know, that's a large number. So what does the research tell us, and what are the implications of that research?
Well, you know, the certainly being abused and neglected it increases the likelihood of a juvenile being arrested for delinquency. It increases the risk of being arrested for a violent crime even more than the 59% among those kids who are there, that this just huge high risk. Kids who are in foster care, for example, you know, approximately 16% of kids placed in foster care are charged with a delinquent act as compared with 9% of all kids who are even abused and neglected. So even among the kids who are abused and neglected, who are probably 8 times more likely than kids in the general population to be arrested, you've got kids who are in placement are even more likely than the whole population of abused and neglected kids. So you have this sort of penetration issue, that you have the general population, and then you look at those kids who've been victimized and the rate begins to go up, and you look at those kids who have been victimized and have needed placement as a result of their victimization, and the rate is even higher for those kids. So you see, you know, sort of see this phenomena of the more harm that's had to come to a child, that's come into a child's life, that a child has experienced, and the more systems are therefore engaged to intervene on behalf of child and family, the more likely it is at each step in the process that that child will become involved in the delinquency system. I did a survey, oh God, this is years ago now, and actually looked at even early education, child welfare, and juvenile justice in one community. It's just one community. And we found the stunning correlation between kids who were identified as having problems in early childhood, early, you know, not kindergarten and pre-K, but kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, early school years, who were identified as not doing well, as having a learning disability, as having a minor behavioral problem, as being identified as having a special ed need early on, or learning concern in those early years, was A, more likely to get to child welfare, and then subsequently more likely to get to juvenile justice. And the track was just phenomenal. It just was stark when we collected the data.
So on a federal policy level, how is this link being recognized and addressed, given just what you just talked about?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things that happen out there that have caught, you know, people have paid attention to. The Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, which we'd all like to see more done with, and reauthorization and movement to the future. And right now, I don't have short-term optimism about that. But as it was reauthorized back in, you know, 2002, 2003, when we took a look at it, at that time, I think there was a lot of real focus on beginning to increase the amount of coordination and between the systems, at least on a basic level, to understand that these two populations of young people were, in fact, often the same, certainly overlapping, and that we therefore needed to have Title IV foster care funds available for those kids. We need to do things like case planning and case reviews for kids in the juvenile justice system, because we understood at that point that the sort of a framework of just holding kids accountable for criminal behavior wasn't enough. We also needed to plan for their future. We also needed to treat their health and mental health needs. We also need to plan for permanency and make sure that they had stable, consistent relationships with adults and others in their family, so that there was a broader range of services that those kids needed, and it really wasn't an either-or, that kids really weren't just JJ kids or child welfare kids, that they really needed services out of both systems, and really that the money should begin to reflect that. Really wanting to also look at the ways that case records and both systems sort of establish treatment planning and those kinds of things. We'd like to see more done with the act going forward. We'd certainly like to see Congress take it up and take the next generation of policies and procedures and incorporate them and into the next reauthorization. But as of right now, that's a battle that I think we have to have another day.
Well, without taking this too far off track of our topic, because we probably have a lot of advocates and people interested, is there anything that you can recommend that they look to or can do to help the reauthorization process?
Well, first off, stay informed. I mean, look at, you know, the website for the Law Center, look at the website for Child Welfare League of America. We routinely post any updates of what's going on. I imagine you all do too. So stay abreast, get yourself on the listservs, the policy listservs that all of the organizations run on these things. Write to Congress when you need to. Talk to your congressman in the community about the needs of the kids in your community so that they understand that this is a local issue in their jurisdiction. I think it's really critically important that they get that this is an issue. I also think we've got a short-term opportunity with the reauthorization of CAPTA. You know, the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act really addresses the front end of the child welfare system, but it's also a place where new models can be tested. So always, it's a place where collaborations, cooperative models of practice, et cetera, allow to be tested. There's a little, it's not a big pot of money, but states often use it to do a little bit of model building, model testing, et cetera. And that's also a place where language can be incorporated, et cetera. And that will, we hope, have some movement in the weeks and months ahead.
Thanks.
And they should look for information about that too. And they can go to our website at cwla.org. And my guess is they can go to yours. And I don't know what your URL is off the top of my head, but they can sure go there too.
I'll give it at the end of the show. You know, you were talking about your early days, and I remember 16 years ago as a prosecutor, every day, sort of you knew the families would come in. Mm-hmm. Same families on the dependency, delinquency, many times with cases simultaneously in both jurisdictions.
Right.
So given that, what should courts, attorneys, social service, and treatment providers consider when dealing with dual jurisdiction youth?
Well, I think, you know, it's always a challenge because there's always a lot to sort of take a look at. But I think that I think how we work together to handle these cases is critical. And I think some of the things that I would recommend really apply to all of the systems. And I think the courts can be a place where this kind of can, on a case level, be coordinated. And I think in the administration of child welfare and juvenile justice, these are the places where this stuff can get sort of hammered out administratively. But I think about how do you do the sort of screening and assessment for these cases? How do you really understand what the full array of needs are for these kids? So I think that we've had a history over many, many years of looking at these kids through our individual legal mandates in both systems. So what are we responsible for? And I think you still have to have a lead. You know, the JJ system and the courts on the juvenile side are, you know, have one set of responsibilities, and the courts on the child welfare side have another set of responsibilities. But the child needs a comprehensive assessment that addresses both sets of concerns. So, and it really isn't simply a matter. We often get the battle down to what I think is about placement. You know, should the child be in detention, or should the child be in foster care, residential treatment? There, and therefore, whose job it is and whose money is it? I think that a stepping back to a more comprehensive look at what the young person's needs might be give us a more full assessment of the child and a better way to think about coordinating services and looking at services. So then we can, you know, from there you can, I think, take a look at things like how do you assign the case, who's working on this case, you know, what do people on both systems know, or, you know, if it's the probation worker or it's the caseworker or whatever, what are the workers who are working with this child, young person in the family, know about this case, and what do both courts know? You know, I mean, in the ideal world, you got one family, you got one judge, you got one caseworker. Mm-hmm. Often we don't always have that luxury, so we've got to find ways, I think, to coordinate and manage the assignment of cases, the flow of cases, the planning and supervision, and then which brings us to the notion of collaboration. How do you actually work together systemically to make sure all of the work is on the table? So I think that for me, that's, you know, part of the dilemma and challenge of doing this work. I guess, you know, one of the things that we often start with collaboration, Lauren, and how do we sit down together to sort all of this out? And I would say that's a very good place to start, so long as we kind of go back and have a youth's eye view of the world,
mm-hmm.
And really sit in the chair of a young person for a minute and experience the movement in the system. And experience their movement in the system, the sort of chaoticness of which the lack of coordination we have functions. So, and I think when you do that, when you sit in the chair of the young person for a minute and their family, it brings you to a very different place about why collaboration and coordination is so necessary. And it helps to address those things that I think go beyond what we might logically come up with is folks who sit in systems trying to figure out how to, we can play better together. And I think it drives us towards playing together better in a way that actually is helpful as opposed to a way that works for us,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean.
Definitely. I often think about the youth and families, and it was a small jurisdiction, so it was the same players all the time
mm-hmm.
with them,
mm-hmm.
that they may not even realize that we were talking about different systems at a time or the different consequences that were really in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have a question that's come in from Kim, and at this point I also want to encourage other people to call in.
Mm-hmm.
That would be 347-994-1149 or post in the chat room like this one. So Kim asks, recognizing that many kids who come into the delinquency system move into the deep end of that system, have previous involvement with child welfare, for youth who have experienced trauma and exposure to violence, what approaches are most helpful to them when they are put into a controlled type of correctional setting? Because we've seen many of these youth fail in those types of settings. Do you have some thoughts about that?
I do. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this, and I think this applies to the kids in the deep end and, quite frankly, a lot of kids in the shallow end. I think this goes to me to understanding who these young people are and having conversations with them about what works and having really a trauma-informed approach to our work. I think we sometimes neglect to acknowledge and understand and incorporate the trauma needs of a child in the way we work with them and the way we treat them. We get a clinical assessment or a psychological evaluation done on a child, and the end result is simplified down into, you know, the child needs RTC, residential treatment center. And that may well be true, and it may well be very, very accurate. But we don't understand what that means for how we actually work with a child, and we don't always share with each other and understand what's under it. It becomes just a place that contains the child behaviorally, as opposed to really a place that understands and addresses their trauma. One of the things, I've been doing lots and lots of talking to young people lately, and it's just fascinating. I met a young man recently who, I don't know how many residential treatments he's been in, but it's a lot. And at the end of the day, he's now 19. He would tell you, and I think he had one or two brushes. I don't think he ever went in deep end of the juvenile justice system, but he did have a couple of brushes. And what he would say to you today, now that he's sort of, you know, stable and reasonably stable, at least for the moment, and somewhat on his feet, is that as much as he acted out, was crazy and beyond himself, and as he would describe it, he needed treatment, he needed residential, and he needed a lot of other things. And he's still struggling with trauma that he experienced in his childhood in many, many ways. But one of the things that he has said to me was that people didn't understand what his reaction. So he didn't kind of get it. He didn't understand what the treatment program was about, why he was going there,
mm-hmm.
why he, you know, so he reacted defensively. He reacted negatively. He was behaviorally probably impossible for everybody, both in foster care before he got there and there. And he felt no control over his life. He had no input in decision making. He had no voice in anything. And And it's easy for us to say that kids who behave badly, you know, need someone else to be making decisions because they're making such poor decisions. But this is a pattern, this, you know, this not having information is a pattern that goes back for a lot of these kids all the way to their early childhood when they were first removed, when they first had CPS involvement, and they went to stay to auntie's house or grandma's house, or they went to foster care and nobody told them why. So that they had the separations, then they had the lack of information, and those things compound. Many of the crossover kids have been in care 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. So these are kids who've been in care a long time, and they've experienced lots of loss, lots of changes, and lots of not understanding what's happening next to them. And they're now at 14, 15, 16 years old, approaching an age where every kid in the world wants some say in their life. So we have this sort of developmental milestone that happens for them that they can't experience normally. And kids will tell you, I want something normal in my life, that RTC takes away normalcy. I have to get permission to go spend the afternoon with friends. I have to get permission to do this. I have to get permission to do that. And we know that, you know, because of their risk to themselves, the risk to the community, the risk to others, that we have to be very cautious about what we do with them. But at the same time, we kind of need to understand that we're depriving them of normalcy in a lot of ways, and that that has an impact as well. So for me, really getting under the nuances of what trauma experiences young people have had, how that's showing up in their life today, what their feelings are about where they are and where they're going, is really just critically important to getting us to a place where we do a better job in the practice and the service delivery that we do for them. And family engagement, you know, kids, no matter how bad their families are, go back to their families sooner or later. So what do we do about that, you know, when they're 15 and we've separated them from their families? How do we begin to think about those things?
I think it's so challenging. Are there some – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay.
I was going to say, so family engagement is always a challenge that communities mm-hmm. and systems talk about, and you're even adding we need to – engage our youth in the process
right.
as well. Are there some promising practices that communities are doing around this right now that you can speak to that our listeners can look into, especially when trying to work with crossover youth and prevent, you know, more intervention work?
Well, you know, I don't know as many of them in the crossover area, but I do know them certainly in the child welfare area. I think there are lots of good practices going on. But I think that, you know, for me, I think things like team decision-making, which I think is happening in both child welfare, juvenile justice, and with crossover kids, is really important, whether it's family team conferencing and or multidisciplinary conferencing, where you're actually bringing family, youth, community providers, others together to sit around a table to talk about and think about a plan. Child welfare does a lot of work on family finding, of sort of finding that network of people that's a support, of beginning with a parent, beginning with a child, and saying, who's in your family, so that we understand what their connectedness is. And literally following sort of, I call it sort of like a, you know, a trail of crumbs to find the different aunts, uncles, cousins, et cetera, who may be a resource to a child. So that you're beginning to, even as you think about the things that have to happen in the child welfare system, the things that are happening as a result of adjudication processes, how do you weave family practice into that? Lots of the treatment programs around the country are modeling things out of things like the Building Bridges Initiative that's happening around the country with residential treatment and community-based providers. And in those programs, there's a huge effort to really bring for kids, both adjudicated and not, in the both on the JJ side and the child welfare side, to bring to the table the parents, the family, so that the residential treatment model is much more of a wraparound model, so that the community-based providers that are working with family are engaged with the youth's plan, and vice versa, even when that youth isn't living in community and the, you know, living as family. concept. So you really look at ways to wrap around the young person, the family that's going to be there after we're all gone, and that you wrap around them community providers who are going to be there, who will be part of, you know, helping to reduce recidivism and those kinds of things and reentry down the line as you're going through treatment, as you're going through the adjudication process. So for me, those things, both team decision making and wrapping services around child and family as they go through the process, are really critical pieces on the practice side of helping to make those things happen. And then I think communities that do youth engagement activities and family engagement activities on a systems level, so that they're sure that as they think about, you know, building the collaboration teams and bringing the coalition of folks together who needs to work on this issue, that they've got that youth and family perspective at the table as they talk about how to model and change the system. I think it will make huge difference. I was doing some work here in the D.C. area recently, and they had a panel of, gosh, like 5 or 6 youth. And it wasn't a sort of come and, you know, present for 30 minutes and share your wisdom and then be gone. No, these young people stayed for 3 days worth of intensive planning about finding better permanency outcomes for young people, older youth particularly, in care. So they were able to talk about the ways that they wanted to find permanency, the role they wanted to have in identifying the adults who were important in their lives and could be resources for them. All of that kind of stuff that really, I think, helps them feel engaged, whether it's on the systems level or on a case level, in their future.
Well, and we had a question from Doug that something you really just talked about, which is the struggle of reentry for you in correctional settings when they have been taken away from their families,
yeah,
and they often, like, no one's been working with them, and maybe they didn't start with a very stable living condition and even enter the juvenile justice through the child welfare. Is there thoughts about what we can do in those situations? I know that when I was practicing, often child welfare system was used for youth who came back into their communities after being institutionalized for both services and for placement.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not, and none of those were actually ready or, you know, or suited to assist those youth.
Right.
Do you have some thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think if we don't plan them to be ready, they won't be ready, you know, and they won't be appropriate. And I think part of what we've had is this, you know, this sort of system, and I think you hit the nail on the head where you know, the child gets done with adjudication. The JJ system has the placements that work and, you know, work and support kids in juvenile justice and are fairly successful with those young people. And then when they're done, they call the child welfare system, which has designed another set of placements for kids not necessarily adjudicated, et cetera. They're not planned for post, you know, post placement services out of JJ. They're planned for something else. They're created for something else. You get kids who go into foster care where foster families don't have the proper supports, don't have a real understanding of the child. So for me, the placement, there needs to be a lot more joint development of resources and a lot more coordination about what are you doing for planning. To me, that critical point of exit from care from JJ, where a child might go back into the community or back into child welfare, is another assessment point, is another point where you just, you know, you sort of say, you can't simply say, okay, he's done, she's done, let's just find a place for him to be, and that's often the conversation. We just need a placement now that he's done. What you need is another assessment that says, what does he need in a placement? You know, what is he? Where can he live and succeed? What does it take to wrap any services that are necessary? Are there continuing needs for mental health services? What are the family connections that need to be built or rebuilt or maintained? You know, what kind of schooling does he need? What kind of transportation? What kind of supervision and guidance day in and day out will help him be her be successful? So it's a much more nuanced level of coordination than many of our systems are used to doing, where the answer has often been, where do we put the kid?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can help. And I think those models exist. But, again, I think it's an assessment process and a team planning and a team decision-making process.
How can really thinking about how to better serve our youth who are in both systems help decrease disproportionate minority contact and other related issues? Is there a connection with that?
Ask the question again, Lauren. Make sure I understand what you're asking.
For communities to really start thinking about how they can better serve the dual
mm-hmm.
jurisdiction youth,
yep.
is there also a benefit in decreasing DMC, disproportionate minority contact, and sort of other related issues of overrepresentation?
Yeah, I absolutely think there are. I think this whole issue, I mean, if you look at disproportionate disparities, and what they call it in the child welfare system, and DMC as it's called in JJ, and I have no idea what education calls it.
it's all DMC, and it stands for this different thing.
Yeah, exactly. But it really is about the disproportionate and disparate treatment of kids of color across all of our systems, and why they're handled differently, and why we have so many of them. And I think, you know, I'll go back to the case in Maryland, because I want to back up and start at the beginning of the system and then go back to the end of the system. When I talked to those teachers, I did a session once, and I said, talked to a group of teachers about why they were referring these kids to child welfare, because once they understood the numbers and saw that they were referring disproportionate kids of color, very interesting things came out. One of them was this whole question of level of comfort and discomfort in working with families of color, families from other ethnic backgrounds, families who were immigrants. So that the teachers and others in the school system, A, didn't always know the resources in those communities. They didn't always know the families. They didn't always have the skills to work with them. They're teachers. They're not social workers, after all. So they didn't have the skill sets to work with these families across different cultures and across different communities. So they often needed help and support, and often the referral was about that they couldn't really find a way to engage the family to make things better for the child. Now, sometimes that's because the family had problems, and sometimes it was, frankly, discomfort level on the school side. So that sort of started the scenario, and I think it continues across the system that we're not always very good at tapping into the networks that children and family come from and into the communities that they are engaged in. So we see a mom and a dad, if there is both are in somewhere in the picture, who has, you know, a drug problem, is poverty problem, lacks adequate housing, et cetera. And we often make huge assumptions that the family, that no one in the family and therefore no one in the community is anything but poor, drug addicted, et cetera. And we don't always know how to find our way through this chain of family members to find the resource in that family who's strong, viable, capable, and able to support that child. So we end up with more likelihood that we'll bring that child into a system because we don't know the strengths in the family because we don't readily see them. So I think it's really important that we find ways to find the strengths in the families in both systems. And it may not be the family member that's standing in front of us. It may be another family member. And I think that we have to sort of look at, and then, you know, and that's at the practice level, sort of understanding, you know, how we find family strengths, how we work across culture, how we work across community. If you go up to a systems level, we have to understand and believe that this is actually an issue. And the numbers tell us that. The numbers repeatedly tell us that in every community, that the deeper into the system you get, the more you have disproportionality, the more you have disproportionate confinement, disproportionate placement, disproportionate substantiation in a child abuse and neglect. So we have to understand what those numbers mean, and we have to be willing to share those numbers with each other and talk about those numbers. And then I think we have to plan how it is we can use that information to help us understand the problems underneath that are creating that and to build the resources, programs, and mechanisms that help support our getting away from that, moving back from that. So then the responses become very targeted at these kids who are making this path from child welfare entry into this crossover population. Mm-hmm. And we focus very heavily on them. Now, that's not simply a matter of talking about racism and talking about cultural competence and saying we're going to become more culturally competent. In reality, it's doing good case practice with each and every kid. It's the most likely thing to get us there. Sure, we need to understand all of those things. But when we adopt a child and family-centered kind of thinking about how we work with a family, more than likely we'll also be very culturally relevant and culturally responsive. And I think be able to then solve that individual case, and that case becomes a way of looking at cases that helps us get to, you know, addressing DMC in a meaningful way. So for me, you have to sort of get the data down, get the information down. You have to look at individual family practice and really begin to address family practice on a concrete basis. And I think there probably are a handful of other things that you can do as well, but I think those are among the two things that you really need to do.
Terrific answer. We're starting to wrap up a little bit here. We have somebody who said they're going to be calling in, but while we're waiting for that, for those listening in who are not familiar with the Child Welfare League of America and its work, mm-hmm. maybe you can provide a quick overview.
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to. CWLA has been around for a long time. What year is this? 2010. We're 90 years old. And I'm not 90, but we are, collectively. And we are, you know, we are a national membership organization that advocates on behalf of children, youth, and families at the federal level. We do a little bit of state advocacy, but most of our policy advocacy is on the federal level. We also do training, consultation, education, publications, et cetera, and set standards for practices around child welfare services. And we take on a lot of what I would call emerging and cutting-edge issues that we think are important to solve the concerns of vulnerable kids and families in America. So we took on this question of, you know, crossover kids and the connection between JJ and child welfare. We've taken on things like incarcerated parents who have children in the child welfare system, et cetera. So those on a long, long list of them over the years. Some things that we think are really important to move the state of practice, to help our systems function better, to meet their missions of serving kids, protecting children, and creating healthy development in our young people. So we are located here in Washington, D.C., and we work all across the country in all 50 states doing the work that we do. And we're available. We have our website, and we're available to talk to people, share with people, and keep people abreast both on the policy level and on practice about issues that we form and work on. We're getting ready to start a new series of what we're calling roundtable dialogues that will be going out and talking with communities about things that they are of concern in these days of short budgets and big problems, and talking about how communities address some of these very complex issues like crossover, like finding permanency for older youth and those sorts of things.
Okay. I was hoping Angela has actually posed a question through the chat, and I wanted some clarification. But I think it's really kind of something you've talked about. In we're working in a climate of limited resources and funding, and you talked about, you know, really taking the time to getting to know the family and the youth. She wants to know what suggestions you have for small ways to be more aware of these nuanced issues in day-to-day practice, and maybe even engaging practitioners that you're working with.
I think that's really a great question. I think there are little tiny ways, and one of the ways, I don't know what her role is in a community, but for me, little things like sitting down, you know, in addition to sitting down with youth and families to talk about the nuances, sit down with caregivers who are providing care, treatment programs, sit down with caseworkers. You'll find, you know, we often think that the problem is the big systems issue, and often it is, but then we think we fixed the big system problem, and somehow the problem still persists. But if you talk to the worker, they'll say, well, yeah, we believe that. I had someone recently tell me that, you know, more states needed to do concurrent planning, and why wasn't concurrent planning happening, and why wasn't concurrent planning working? And when you look at it, workers believe in concurrent planning. They believe that kids should, you know, just like in the crossover kids where you really should be planning around their JJ needs and planning around their child welfare needs, that makes logical sense to workers in both systems. So what are the barriers that get in their way of actually doing it? And you've got to talk to the workers to know that. You've got to talk to the workers to say, well, I'd love to plan jointly in the child welfare system about placement, but the child welfare placements aren't really geared to this. Or, you know, I can't get a referral on a day. Or, you know, or the facility that doesn't really get it, it doesn't have enough space, so I have to go to plan B, and then the play case doesn't go as well as I want it to. So It helped that those conversations help you understand whether you've got a resource problem, a coordination problem, an information sharing problem. I think it also helps understand the other little things that make the difference in the life of a young person. You know, placements often don't blow up because one big thing happens. Placements blow up because a series of small things build into big things. And if we understand the small things, we can probably prevent the placement blow up that dumps the kid in the street, that makes the kid angry, that makes the kid upset and act out, that makes the kid get in trouble, you know, all of those things that lead to penetration further into the system. By understanding that the trigger might have been, the first thing in that might have been, I didn't get to see mom, I don't know why I'm in this placement, I didn't get to participate in that after-school activity, and that those things that on top of each other, go unaddressed. You create a scenario in which a child's behavior gets less and less manageable, and his life gets more and more out of control, and he gets in greater and greater trouble. So to me, on a preventive basis, those nuanced things about attending to a child's trauma, placement, information needs really will help us keep kids from the deep end, keep kids from having the worst trauma-related experiences that they can have, and hopefully begin to address their trauma earlier.
Well, we have 3 minutes left, and we have another question, which is a really large question from Don. So maybe I'll give you a minute to respond to start on that. And I think, Don, we're going to be taking this up on some other shows as well, and then I will reserve a minute to wrap up, okay?
Sure.
So Don asks, she wants to know your thoughts about the rights or the lack of rights with minors, that she lives in Wisconsin, and we're third in the country in juvenile incarceration rates. And she is very concerned with the police ability to go into schools and question kids about what's happening and about crimes that may have been committed or activities outside of the school ground. So she wanted to know your thoughts about that.
Yeah. It's a very, very monstrous question, but I will try to answer it very simply. We have been working very, very diligently over the last probably 20 years, and certainly most recently in the last year or so, on advocating for ratification on the Convention of the Rights of the Child, which is the UN Convention. And that does really, I think, advance the notion of children's rights more aggressively than what we have codified in law. Does it go to the place where kids are in charge and adults aren't? No, I think it's more reasoned than that. But I do think it speaks to giving children a little more rights to make decisions, a little more rights to be heard and considered, and a little bit more protection in those regards. I think we haven't yet found the right balance of those things, and I think that there are some principles that kids feel pretty violated when those things happen to them in their teens, when they're in school, And, you know, they spent, they just came on a, you know, civics class where they've learned, you know, about rights being the foundation of American society. And then they, you know, they understand that these things don't apply to them. Not that they don't apply to them, that they apply to them in a modified way as kids, which is probably where we need to be, that they apply to them in a modified way. We're still at, they just don't apply. And I think we could make some progress there. And I think youth engagement will help us.
Okay. Thank you. We're getting the 60-second warning.
Uh-huh.
So, Linda, I really want to thank you for taking the time to be here today and thank the listeners for tuning in. I'd also like to thank Ansa Copeland, who's been behind the scenes answering calls. Mm-hmm. Next up on Spotlight for Youth is the director for the Center of Innovative Practices. He'll be joining us on November 30th to talk about evidence-based practices as they relate to community-based behavioral mental health services and reducing reliance on incarceration. To stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can follow us here at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth, or as Linda mentioned, come to Children's Law Center's website, which is childrenslawky, which stands for Kentucky.org. So have a good day, and we'll see you here next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you again, Linda.
Thank you, Lauren. It's terrific.